somebody with Tourette's, somebody with autism or deep depression, anxiety, those kinds of areas of mental health are going to have higher levels of empathy or sense of emotion, elevated emotions, and they might be able to apply that really well within their research.
Hello and welcome to This Is HCD. My name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a designer, educator, and I'm the host of This Is HCD, based in the wonderful city of Dublin, Ireland. Now, our goal here is to have conversations that inspire and help move the dial forward for organisations to become more human-centred in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. Now, this episode that you're about to hear is with Felicia Araniti from SCAD University in Savannah, Georgia in the US. Now, Felicia connected with me several years ago when we ran the first Doing Design Festival and recently published a really cool visualization that caught my attention online titled Neurodiversity Within Human-Centered Design Practice. Now, I connected some of the dots between a conversation or an episode with Brigitte Metzler about how certain neurodiverse minds may be well suited or better suited to aspects of design. And it was a throwaway comment by me at the time, but Felicia has been researching in this space for a while now, following her own diagnosis with ADHD. We discuss that in a little bit more detail as well. It's a really good episode, but before we jump in, if you like what we're doing here at This Is HCD, please help us out by leaving a review wherever you're listening to the podcast. It only takes a couple of minutes, but it really helps the findability of the podcast and helps share the word to other change makers around the world. Or you can go one better and by becoming a patron, and you can get an ad-free stream of the podcast for as little as €1.66 per month. That's two cups of coffee in Dublin. And you also get a shout out as thanks on whatever podcast is coming up next. There are other plans where you can get exclusive items too, and literally all the money goes to editing, hosting and maintaining our website, which is now a repository for human-centered design goodness with over 220 episodes, folks. Anyway, let's jump straight into this episode. Felicia Araniti, I'm delighted to have you on the podcast. Welcome to This Is HCD. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born and raised in Dallas, Texas. I currently reside in Savannah, Georgia. And I'm a current master's student here at the Savannah College of Art and Design studying service design.
Right. Okay. So a shout out to Ricardo Martins, who actually had nothing to do with this introduction. This was an interaction between myself and yourself on LinkedIn. And you're telling me it happened a couple of years ago. We were maybe chatting a little bit during the Doing Design Festival. And it's great to finally have you on the podcast, Felicia. But maybe you mentioned that you're doing a master's in service design, but the premise for this podcast and this specific episode was an image you created, or an illustration you created about neurodiversity within human-centered design practices. And when I saw that, I thought this could have been a really fantastic conversation to have around neurodiversity within the fields. So maybe if you're okay to talk about it, what's your own journey and your own involvement with neurodiversity within your own life?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a bit of I kind of consider myself a late bloomer, but when you kind of look at statistics, women around my age, this is actually the time that a lot of women get diagnosed, just because women and men tend to have different spectrums of when certain symptoms really come to light. And I don't want to say, I say symptoms loosely, but I got diagnosed in November of 2021 and officially diagnosed with ADHD, depression, anxiety, and then complex PTSD. And then I recently have been diagnosed with a bipolar mania disorder. I believe it was in August of 2022.
Okay, so this is all relatively quite new in your life in the last 12 months that these discoveries have been made. What was, you know, maybe take me a bit on the journey of what led you to getting diagnosed. And if you're okay to talk about any of those things, like what did the symptoms look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So One of the key things that I've started to learn across this journey is that you have to be vulnerable. You have to allow vulnerability to kind of seep in, because that's when you get a lot of meat to the context. But also, you're not doing yourself any justice by leaving any details out. When I was younger, I really struggled in primary school. I really struggled when I was in kindergarten and, you know, those first years, because I didn't adhere to the structure. I didn't understand why I needed to adhere to a structure, right? Follow the line, sit in your assigned seat. We have to do this this way. We have to do this at this time. And, you know, I really gave my teachers a bit of a struggle. I remember my mom always telling me during the parent-teacher conferences that I was like, hey, Felicia doesn't really, 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 you know, understand this. Maybe you could kind of help her at home. And, you know, having two older siblings who, you know, I will say were neurotypical, and my mom didn't really have to struggle with these experiences mm-hmm. with them. It was a bit of a challenge for her. So she would just say, well, just do what the teacher says, you know, kind of, you know, what's going on. And I just told my mom, I was like, well, I don't understand why I need to do this. So I was really, really stuck on the emphasis of why. And finally, I started to just understand, okay, the person next to me is doing this. The teacher commends this kind of behavior. This person is doing what the definition of successful is. Let me go ahead and adopt these person's traits as my own, and then, you know, mimic and mask, and then push forward. And that process was very, very successful for me. I remember, you know, I quickly became, you know, a really good student. You know, my mom was saying, okay, hey, this is great. You know, keep doing what you're doing. And so I adopted that until I reached college. And then by the time I started my first year at the university at SCAD, that's when I started to have a little bit more of a challenge, because now the ball was in my court. I had a little bit more sense of control with my life and what I wanted to do. And a lot of those teachers in those beginning art classes were very abstract with our projects. They would say, hey, this is the basis, you know, and then you kind of take it from there. And I kind of struggled a bit. And I was like, man, my whole life I've been kind of told what to do. And now I really get to kind of drive this, and I'm struggling. And that's when I first started to seek psychiatric help. I found my first therapist at the age of 18. And here I grew up as somebody who didn't really think there was anything wrong with me per se. And by the time, you know, I started talking to a therapist, they started to kind of really dig deep into my childhood and really try to understand, you know, why I am the way that I am. Why am I, you know, this kind of neurotic person with these neurotic tendencies? And growing up, I remember I would tell my mom, Mom, I just don't understand. And I would tell her, I was like, Mom, I just don't think like A, B, C, right? I might think like A, D, B, C, X. And my mom's like, okay, well, just keep doing what you're doing and keep doing what's successful. And so I kind of had to kind of really compress and suppress these tendencies that I had, because it wasn't what was accepted. And when I got to college, I'm like, okay, let's dive deeper into this. Let's dive deeper into understanding why I feel the need to mask, and, you know, where does that stem from? And that's where that journey started. Was back in 2016.
Okay. It's so you've been on this journey for about 6 years, effectively. Like you've been, you know, exploring and delving into your past, which is always good. In my experience, I've done the same for many years in a similar time zone as well. Or time period, should I say. So going back to your childhood and the bit that you mentioned there about structure and following structure and mimicking is something that I've heard quite a lot from my own peers who've gone through this journey. But where I'm interested to focus this conversation is your journey as a designer and how you found design. Was that something that happened just kind of organically, or... Because the illustration that you created there shows that there's a real strength in neurodiversity in regards to certain fields of design, and I'm really interested to see how you landed into the world of design and what parts of design really stimulate your brain and feel like this is where you don't have to follow structure so much. You don't have to mimic, you don't have to play the role of the child, so to speak. So maybe tell us a little bit more around that journey as well, if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I originally started applying for colleges, I have two older sisters who at this point had already gone to school, graduated, and were giving me a lot of advice, right? One of my older sisters studied film and television at the University of Oklahoma, and then my other sister studied business and engineering over at the Texas A&M. And you know, I was taking a bit more of a different route. I knew that I wanted to go to a school that was creative and in the arts, but I didn't necessarily know what. So at the time I said, well, I'm really good at drawing and I love animation. I was really obsessed with Studio Ghibli films at the time. So I signed up. I went to SCAD for animation, took a class, did not like it. So I was a bit disheartened. I'm like, okay, well, I still have the opportunity. Let me see what else is out there. At the time, my roommate was an architecture major. And she struggled a lot with fine arts. And she was like, well, Felicia, you're so good at it. You're so good at abstract thinking and applying yourself. And I remember we'd stay up until like 3 a.m. I'd be helping her with her projects once I finished my projects and be like, okay, cool. You know, this is something that works really well. This is something that you could do. I think your teacher would really like this. And she was really trying to pull me into that kind of the School of Building Arts. She's like, I think you would do really well in architecture or interior design. And I was like, okay, well, let me check it out. So started kind of looking, and from architecture, I found interior, and then from interior, I found furniture design. And then I said, okay, well, furniture design is a branch of product design. So let me go ahead and do product design, which at SCAD is industrial design. Switched my major, took a class in industrial design, loved it. I had a professor, and the first thing that he said, he walked in, he said, okay, your assignment is to build a pair of shoes out of any material you want, and it is due in 2 days. And he's like, if your shoes fall apart, he said he's going to have us run in up and down the hallway, and if our shoes fall apart, we fail. And, you know, then he's like, all right, class dismissed, go ahead and start working. And we're all just like, what? And, you know, it was just like, you know, and at first it's really, really intimidating. But I remember coming back and saying, okay, what do I know what to do? What can I do? And that in itself is really stimulating, that kind of drive and sense of, you know, kind of just jumping into an abyss and don't really know what the outcome of it was really exciting. The further that I kind of got into my industrial design program, that's when I started to have a little bit more kickback by my professors. My professors would say, you know, hey, Felicia, you're doing really great on the concept. And I've seen you've worked a lot of time on understanding, you know, why users are going to use this product, you know, what gravitates towards them, X, Y, Z. He's like, but I'm not grading you on that. I'm grading you on the physical item itself. And right now your product is lacking. And I was just like, I know, but isn't the concept really great? And, you know, they would be like, it is, but you know, that's not what I'm grading you on. You know, if I'm asking you to make a tray, or I want to see what your craftsmanship is like. So then I had a professor pull me aside during a one-on-one, and he was like, Felicia, I think you're great, but I think you're in the wrong major. And of course, that's nothing any student wants to hear. So he said, I'm going to go ahead and take you across the hall and introduce you to a professor. And that's when he introduced me to Xenia at the time. And she was the chair of service design back in 2016. And I had that conversation with Xenia, and Xenia's like, well, you know, worst comes to worst, you take a class, you don't like it, it counts on as an elective, and you continue on your industrial design course. So then I took the class, and it tickled something different within me. And I didn't understand what that was until probably earlier this year, where I was able to kind of let my walls down. There was no more masking. There was no more mimicking. It was bringing my true authentic self to the table. And that was because I was adding that human element, that human perspective of, okay, if I do this way, how can I apply my thought process into understanding why other people do this way?
Okay.
And that's really where I was like, nope, this is it. Called my mom and said, hey, mom, I know that you don't want to hear this, but I'm changing my major for the third time. And I promise it's going to stay. And my mom's like, please do. You know, at this time I'm giving my mom a heart attack every time I'm saying, okay, I'm switching my major and I'm taking a couple extra classes. I might have to stay a little bit longer than the traditional 4 years.
That's cool. I mean, like, it's great that you had the support from your family as well to be able to make that switch over to service design and do the master's over there in SCAD. But I guess I'm really interested to see why you feel a neurodivergent mm-hmm. mind and brain. What is it about that brain that suits the intangible, shall we say, in around service design? Because a lot of the experiences that we design within service design are invisible, and they have to be, you know, fixed, or the sequencing and putting things in order and structure and so forth. How does that lend itself to be more kind of supported by a neurodivergent brain, do you think?
I want to say, so going back to my diagnosis of ADHD, and one, there's a stimulating factor that you have multiple outlets to kind of get that stimulation, whether it's the person-to-person interaction, the synthesizing and analysis, right, or the actual prototyping phase. You're constantly doing something different. You're not always going to be doing the same thing. Every project's going to be different. And you have that safety net of being able to take a new approach and knowing there's some value in this. Regardless of which approach I take, there's no wrong, but there is you have that safety net of saying, I could take it this way and I still did something impactful with my work. And so that sense of validation, one, lessens the amount of fear in an individual, allows them to bring their true authentic self, and then kind of push forward with that narrative. And I think one thing that resonated with me, having that kind of safety net built and having that kind of foundation built within my classes, it really allowed me to kind of sprout in multiple different directions, right? The sun might be pointing in one way, but I want to kind of explore this darkness. Let me see what's over here that's not really being there. And then there was the point of always touching onto the emotional element of users. Mm-hmm. And I think that hasn't always been seen. So the opportunity for somebody to say, hey, I'm experiencing something negative and I want to touch into it. I want to explore deeper. And that for me was such a big eye opener, because my whole life I was constantly told to reform, to kind of follow this A style, or, you know, AB style learning, and be this kind of person. So I was constantly told what to do. And then all of a sudden I have this opportunity to really jump in and say, hey, this is something negative. This is a negative experience, and we want to make it better. So there was that kind of bit of like this hero concept or this hero journey going on, right? Saying, hey, I've experienced negative experiences in my life, but I'm going to take all of that and kind of persevere, be this kind of phoenix rising out of the ashes, and say, I want to make these experiences better for people. So I had that drive, I had that motivation, and I don't think I ever knew how to kind of apply it. And it wasn't until I got to service design and it was like, wow, I can really make things better for people. And it probably wasn't until this year that I said, wow, I can really make these experiences better for people that are like me.
Sure.
And I was able to bridge those two together.
It's interesting because when I'm hearing you speak, when you look back to your childhood and how you mimic the system or the game, so to speak, of like how to get ahead, what can result is an academically standard type person at the end of the conveyor belt, so to speak. So it's there seems to be a gap there in the academic system where we're not really supporting neurodivergent people to succeed. We're not able to flex the educational process to be more inclusive. So that's something that we'll probably be all aware of at some point. We all have to conform to basically to perform and basically get a grade at the end of it that reflects on our intelligence, which isn't entirely reflective of who we are as a person. So it's really interesting to see where, you know, it looks like it was your friend that really guided you through that. It wasn't the academic process. It wasn't the educational system in America. It was your friend that actually stepped in and was your signpost, so to speak, to architecture and then industrial design and then service design. I'm going to just probably speak a little bit out of line here, but my experience with ADHD, I'm not ADHD. Some of my friends have recently been diagnosed, and growing up, it was almost like we would think of the problem child of being people who've got ADHD are the one who are, you know, they're kind of running around and they're not able to sit still, and they're able to just kind of be a little bit more all over the place. That's not necessarily true, okay? And that's my own learning and my own journey to get to this point where I know some seriously successful people who are in ADHD, and I'm interested in the characteristics that you believe an ADHD person has that lends themselves to a specific type of work, like work in service design, you know, being able to flick between the different Zoom levels of design and reality, and being hyper-focused on that attention and detail. Can you talk to me about your own experience in that? And is that something that my perspective, is it right or wrong?
It's a little bit of, I don't want to say it's a little bit of both. I think it's unique with every individual. I think you are correct in the sense that there is the that negative stigma associated with ADHD. And it's actually, ADHD does vary from male to female, or I should just say it varies from person to person. And with me, I was able to, one, be very detail oriented. Was hyper focused, was able to zoom in and understand processes, right? You know, all of a sudden I hyperfixate on a line of ants outside, and it leads me to a bigger can of worms, right? Now all of a sudden I'm following these ants. I'm like, okay, what are they taking? A bread. Okay, where did this bread come from? Okay, I'm seeing that there was somebody left some trash nearby and there was a bag of Fritos on the floor. But then I'm like, okay, where are they taking it? Then I'm able to find the ant's nest. And, you know, all of a sudden I just spent an hour of my life dedicating to observation with these ants outside. Now, how can I apply that within service design? That was one thing that I was like, oh man, I would hyper focus on something. And then, you know, it would take my peers to kind of take me a step back and be like, all right, Felicia, come on, come back to reality. And I think that's the really interesting nature, is you start to see one thing and then you open an entire ecosystem of a bunch of other outlets. And so that's one element of ADHD. Another element is the ability to have multiple perspectives at once. And the way that I kind of see it is, I'll be doing something, right? Writing an essay, typing up an email, and then all of a sudden I'm listening to something else, whether it's music, a podcast. I need something else stimulating me. So I constantly have to have that need to stimulate me, you know, visually, audibly, physically, right? The typing, the sensation of the keys, what the kind of clothes I'm wearing. And the more perspectives and layers that you kind of add into that, the minute that there's a disruption in one of those, you start to kind of immediately dive down and analyze, okay, hey, my computer is twitching or the internet's, you know, going out. Then you're able to take a step back and say, okay, what's going on within my personal ecosystem? How do I need to troubleshoot this? And how can I kind of regain normalcy so I can continue producing work, whatever it is that I'm doing? That same process and methodology can be applied when I'm doing my work, right? So I'm like, okay, I'm looking at multiple different perspectives. I'm almost playing a game of Clue. I have something that stimulates me in this way, something else that stimulates me in this way, X, Y, Z. So when I'm conducting interviews, a lot of the time, even if it's face-to-face, I always let the stakeholder on the other end say, hey, I'm going to be taking notes, and my notes might not always be reflective of what you're saying, but it's so I can be stimulated in a way that I can remember what it is that you're saying, and then also kind of synthesize it later on. And I always have to let them know, because sometimes one of the factors about me is that I don't always make good eye contact. And so it's because I have to have that additional line of stimulation when I'm having conversations, whether it's writing down notes so I can make sure that I'm actually focusing on what it is that they're doing, or I'm visually being stimulated by my surroundings. And so, you know, somebody might look at that and say, oh, well, this person's rude, or this person's not paying attention. And it's quite the opposite. I actually had a conversation with an individual who was talking to me, and at the same time I was writing down some notes, and he goes and he says, you know, I really hate it when people say that they're going to listen, but then don't actually listen at all. And I stopped doing what I'm doing. And I look at him and I was like, what makes you think I wasn't listening? He's like, well, you weren't making eye contact with me. And I said, well, how do you know that, you know, by not making eye contact with you that I wasn't listening? And I had to explain to him. And I said, well, I have ADHD. And one of the ways that I enhance into whatever it is that the other individual is doing is by doing something else. So in one way, my mind's not racing so much. I'm kind of slowing down that thought process, not creating so much of a tunnel vision, kind of divert all of that energy into doing another singular task so I can truly focus on what an individual is doing. And when I explained that to him, I said, well, this is XYZ what you said to me. And, you know, then I proposed a solution. What would make you feel comfortable? What would be the response that you would like me to say to make you feel heard? He was like, well, just giving me a response like, oh yeah, or just kind of nodding your head. And I'm like, okay, I will do that. Mm-hmm. I said, but now we know how we can help each other. And he was like, well, thank you so much for that perspective. Cause he's like, I would have never thought. And that was, you know, taking every life experience and saying, okay, this person might think this way. Let me go ahead and make sure that that nobody else feels that way, or, you know, try my best to reduce that.
And it's great that he had the strength to speak up, because too often in the workplace or in social situations, you just kind of make these assumptions that person isn't listening and maybe come to some other conclusion. But so whoever it was, like, it's important to speak up and, you know, try and define how you want to engage is what I'm hearing there. There's other things there that in your illustration that I found really interesting. Okay. And it was, and I'm going to put the visualization up. I'll put a link to it in the show notes for the episode, so people can click into it and see it on LinkedIn and ask you a question if they want to build on it as well. And if you're okay, I might put it on the podcast page as well. And this is HCD and link back as well, just for other people to just find the podcast that way. But there's so many different types of neurodivergent, divergency, so to speak, like dyspraxia, autism, Tourette's, dyslexia and stuff. And there's two things that I'm hearing here. Okay. One, it's really important to have people who are neurodivergent in your kind of the people that you're researching with, but there's also, it's really important to have people who are neurodivergent on your team, just to help improve the processes and be more inclusive. You as a service designer, like, so we spoke about the designing for the intangible and the systems level thinking that's required. In regards to other disciplines like research and stuff, where you have to see patterns amongst large data sets and stuff, do you have any experience on what type of neurodivergent brain is best suited to those, that industry or that part of design?
And yeah, so I'll probably speak on what I've observed and also my own personal experiences. Yeah. So when I was kind of putting this visual together, I was able to kind of get the information from Genius Within Us, which is an organization here within the United States. And they themselves had put together a really nice visual where they categorized these different type of neurodivergent silos and then really highlighted their strengths within it. So when I was putting together this visual, I was like, okay, I know what these individual strengths are who are diagnosed with these different conditions. How can I then reflect that within this design thinking realm? And I then took that information and then was able to kind of say, okay, somebody who Tourette's might have difficulty typing or writing, but they have very keen observational skills. They have really, you know, because they've had to compromise in other areas, they're going to be able to formulate their thoughts and ideas a lot better than maybe somebody else with ADHD. Because there is a big spectrum factor that does play into everybody's diagnosis. Each individual might be a bit different. But I think that's where this visual kind of really wants to play more on strengths than highlighting, okay, these are the pros or cons of an individual and saying, hey, you have these great strengths. Now put yourself and apply yourself in where you feel comfortable or where you feel that you might have the most vitality in the industry. And I was able to kind of also put it together with having conversations with other neurodivergent beings and saying, hey, where do you feel more comfortable throughout this entire process? So, you know, somebody with Tourette's, somebody with autism or deep, you know, depression, anxiety, those kinds of areas of mental health, are going to have higher levels of empathy or sense of emotion, elevated emotions, and they might be able to apply that really well within their research. And so they're probably going to be more centered with the beginning of the process.
I know you're at the towards the middle of your journey in terms of getting your master's. Have you any experience of how organizations are set up to support neurodiversity? Because if we're only supporting a specific type of neuroatypical, presumably there's a lot more work to be done in that space. Is that fair?
100%. And through my own personal experiences, I've had a lot of learning opportunities, but I've had a lot of opportunities where, hey, let me take my personal experiences, see if other people are kind of experiencing the same thing, and then see if we can actually develop a process or inform companies and individuals to kind of be a bit more inclusive. And that's one thing that I think I want to really dive deeper on within my thesis, because I've actually had experiences where the need to disclose that information is necessary. For example, like that conversation with that individual that I had, in order for them to understand my perspective and how I can better have a coherent relationship with that person, I had to disclose that element of myself. And I think in the United States, there is that negative stigma of, okay, if you say too much or you say, oh, I have this, then you're limiting your abilities on what you can do. And I really want to challenge and combat that stigma and say, hey, no, it's not that we're limiting. It's saying, what can I, you know, help me help you? And in order for me to help myself and excel, I have to disclose this to you so you understand how I can gain vitality in this working environment. You know, there were times where, you know, I felt a bit embarrassed if somebody was coming up to me thinking that I wasn't doing my work simply because I had three different devices running at the same time, right? I have a podcast playing, I have a music playing, I have, you know, I'm doing one thing and somebody's going to say, man, this person's insane. How the heck are they listening? But, you know, I'm developing so much white noise so I can actually focus on the one thing that I want to focus on. And to somebody who might be neurotypical, they might not understand that, but it works for me. And at the end of the day, I still produce the work that I want, the work that I'm proud of, and you know, I still produce the outcomes that are needed for whatever it is that I'm applying myself to. But there is that level of vulnerability and being able to disclose yourself within that working environment for somebody else to say, okay, I know what this person's doing. I'm going to trust in their process. And then maybe it's going to kind of open that perspective to me so I can then apply that within other situations as well.
Well, Felicia, we're coming towards the end of the episode here and there's a whole world of conversations we could have off the back of this. And I've bit my tongue in certain areas because, you know, it could be a 10-hour episode on neurodiversity within human-centered design. And just generally just within design, I mean, like there's so much opportunity there to better support people and just be more inclusive. But if people want to reach out to you, what's your preferred way for them to reach out to you?
Absolutely. They can connect with me on LinkedIn. One of the things that I recently did is I signed up to be a mentor on ADP list. So I'm hoping that application goes through. I recently did it about a week ago. So once that gets approved, I'll be posting that on LinkedIn. And so I'll have the opportunity to get connected with a bunch of other individuals and, you know, hopefully be able to give them advice and mentor them and give them that confidence that they need to have these conversations, whether it's with their employer, their professors, or even start these conversations at home. And that's one of the biggest things that I want to push is like, hey, I'm going to be releasing information, but the value that is going to be taken out of the information is based on the person reading it, on the perspective of that individual.
Okay.
And hopefully somebody who is neurodivergent will be able to say, hey, somebody else is experiencing this, and, you know, they're able to apply themselves and be successful. That gives me the confidence to be able to say, I can be successful too.
Okay. Well, it's fantastic that you've put your hand up, because it's always good to have people who are out there kind of on the journey as well, for other people who are at the start of the journey to be able to connect with and ask questions and feel supported. That's how communities work, and that's how networks are formed. So fantastic. I'll put a link to your LinkedIn in the show notes. And the best of luck with the second part of your MA in SCAD. You know, I'm a big believer and a big lover of all the work that's happening in SCAD there with Ricardo, and formerly with Maurizio as well. So keep up the great work. And obviously when you get to that point where you're finished, and if we can help you share any more information or any more findings that you might have had in your journey, please just loop back in. We'll have another episode. It was fantastic speaking with you. Thank you so much for giving me your honesty and your energy, and getting up at a ridiculous o'clock to speak with me as well. I really appreciate it.
No, absolutely. I greatly appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.
There you go, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. And if you enjoyed it and want to listen to more, why not visit thisishcd.com, where you can learn more about what we're up to and also explore our courses whilst you're there. Thanks again for listening.